welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Roslevy, and we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. We've had this show on for about 3.5 years at this point, and it's my pleasure and honor to be with you every week, reporting on our personal health and all the things in our total health environment that impact our health. I've covered the integrative health movement, fracking, environmentalism, food, and a whole range of topics for over 20 years, and I report on the Huffington Post, Alternet, EcoWatch, and a host of other websites, as well as working on a book that connects the dots between some of these topics. Every week on this show, I talk to different scientists, experts, advocates, physicians, environmental leaders, and others about all of the different facets of our social and ecological environment that impact our health and the choices that we make as a society, and whether those are health-oriented choices or not. On today's show, I'm really delighted to welcome someone I've known for many, many years, have had sort of grab conversations here and there at various of the many venues we've been at and conferences and things we've attended due to, you know, our very similar and parallel interests. This is Barbara Glickstein. She's a public health nurse, a health reporter, media strategist, co-director of the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College at the City University of New York. She is also a radio program host. She both produces and hosts Health Styles, an award-winning weekly program on public radio in New York City. And interestingly, Barbara told me that she sees her radio program as a public health practice through providing ongoing coverage of issues that make a difference in our everyday lives. I couldn't agree more. There's all of the physical things, physical and electrical and other things that we do, you know, that we do and that influence our health that are, you know, either supporting our health and life or undermining in various ways. But there also, there's a whole world of understanding, wisdom, and attitudes. And, you know, the kind of health care that we have, the way we see health, our understanding of health, our understanding of how to support health, and our understanding of how to address the issues that undermine health are really all determined out, you know, in the conversations that we have in our communities, via the media, between ourselves and others. And so I share exactly the same feeling and belief that good conversations, grounded conversations about health are really part of the way to health, and that's what we do out here in the media and on Facebook and social media. We kind of have that kind of information offering and dialogue. So I am really, really delighted to welcome Barbara Glickstein to Connect the Dots. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you so much, Allison. And I see your work very much as well as part of a public health platform. In the broadest sense, having followed your work, as you mentioned, we've been colleagues and activist advocates on behalf of many issues, really understand health in the broadest sense of the term, and I see that your work and your use of the media platforms have been doing the same. So it's good to share the airwaves with you today and to have a conversation about things that matter to all the public's health. So thanks for inviting me on.
Well, I'm thrilled, and it's long overdue, but I'm particularly thrilled because you were the first person that I thought to reach out to about some recent events in our society that have long-range health impacts. And, you know, one of the things that we have promoted in the integrative health movement and the self-help movement, which I've been part of, is all of the personal things that we can do to better our health and promote our health and to live healthy lives. And one of the things that we draw attention to on this show and that you do on your show is also the social policy choices, the things we do as a society, and the health impacts of those. So, you know, we're not immune to them. We're not buffered from them. And so it's a really an important reason to engage. And in order to do that, we really have to understand the health impacts. And over the past week or so, we've had a Supreme Court decision about reproductive health rights. So you were the very first person I thought of to come on and both, you know, and explore those implications for people, because what I've seen out in social media is that there is a lot of confusion, and I'm speaking of the decision around Hobby Lobby and the rights of an employer to deny covering mandated federal health coverage that all employers are to provide based on the employer's religious convictions. And so that's the recent decision that we'll be discussing along with others. If you would, Barbara, please orient our listeners, any who are not familiar with this at this moment, to that decision and how you see it.
All right, thank you. I think it's a good place that I'd like to start, if I may, is to remind your listener community that with the passage of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, we fought long and hard, and it was decided that contraception, birth control, would be one of the provisions provided by the Act to ensure that all women and through that decision, the partners that they choose to have sex with would be protected by an access to birth control as part of preventative health care. That meant that insurance companies would have to provide access to reimbursement for birth control, and it would be without a copay, meaning that if you went for a well-woman visit and birth control was part of your well-woman visit care and access to either a device like an IUD or a diaphragm or accessing oral contraceptive, that would now be, which previously it wasn't, part of the sort of core benefits in health insurance. Immediately following that law that was passed, there was the beginning of chipping away, if you will, on how, in fact, those who were opposed not only to access to contraception, but those opposed to the Affordable Care Act, or as some have referred to as Obamacare, began to immediately establish in the courts their angst against these provisions. So first that I want to point out is that what's really important for us to recognize is that this case, Hobby Lobby and Constantega, Burwell versus Hobby Lobby, which was just decided now almost 2 weeks ago, where, as you stated, Allison, that a for-profit company can assert their religious objections to birth control as the benefit in the Affordable Care Act, the Supreme Court actually confirmed its decision and said that, in fact, they would not have to cover this requirement and would limit then the access to contraceptive methods that in anyone working for Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood, who were the two plaintiffs in this case, would now open the floodgates, and which it has, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But again, the issue here is contraception, and it's a case based on contraception. And I think that the incredible amount of outrage against these five all-white men, all Roman Catholic Supreme Court justices' decision to allow this to happen has been a huge wake-up call for many Americans. The latest research shows that 99% of all Americans have practiced some form of contraception. So that's most of the people in the United States. Hobby Lobby claimed in their decision, in this decision, that it only applies to contraception and not to other religious groups which might oppose, such as vaccinations and blood transfusions. However, since this decision, there's been a lot of legal consultation going on whether or not this decision also opened up opportunity for other religious faith-based groups to look at their decisions and their moral code, if you will, of what they want insurance to cover or not. So vaccinations and blood transfusions have been also written about in the last couple of weeks, although no one has come forth saying they're using this decision for denying those rights under their insurance policies for their employees. What has happened is that many forms of birth control have now been reframed, if you will, and mythologized as what's called an abortifacient. And that's a term that means a method that's used that actually causes an abortion or terminates a pregnancy. However, a lot of that was really a profound disagreement from both the women's health community, the medical community, about how the methods that were brought up and when it actually a pregnancy occurs and how contraception prevents pregnancy as opposed to when there is a fertilization and an implantation of an egg into a woman's uterus, is that when is pregnancy begin? So what we're seeing here in this case is this science has been trumped by politics and religious beliefs, and now a definition of birth control as actually being an abortifacient, when in fact the scientific community has disagreed and the medical and women's health community disagrees with this decision. So the decision has implications that are far-reaching beyond the employees of the Hobby Lobby and other organizations and private companies, I should say, corporations that are now claiming religious belief as will allow them to deny access to contraception. So the reason why I'm pointing out this in addition to as part of this decision is that, in fact, even though only four contraceptive methods were at issue in the Hobby Lobby case, two brands of emergency contraception and two models of IUDs, the medical community has gone on record. They were part of the in testifying that these methods should not be considered in this light and they cannot interfere with an established pregnancy. So we have a Supreme Court decision that has supported, a decision based on denying access to contraception on false scientific facts. The other important decision that based the Supreme Court's decision on this is about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was actually signed into being an act back in the under the Clinton administration, and now in terms of the aftermath of the Hobby Lobby decision, the Democratic Party are actively working to present both legislation in the House and in the Senate that will create a smaller window under that religious act so that this can begin to change the, challenge the Supreme Court decision. So as early as yesterday, Senator Harry Reid, the Democrat from Nevada, announced that the Democrats are taking up legislation to address the Supreme Court decision, and by doing that, they are hoping to limit the ruling. I do want to also point out, of course, what we all know is that getting anything passed in the House or in the Senate during this administration is pretty much impossible. So what's happened since then? I'm happy to report, because I think it's important for those who are working in companies that are now using this denial to prevent the very costly access to birth control, some options. I don't know exactly all that they are, but I do want to say that just this week Planned Parenthood stepped up, and they have posted a text hotline for women to contact them by texting them and telling them that this decision has, in fact, they're reporting a denial of coverage. And that we can repeat it again during your program, but you text the two words birth control, and the text number is 69866. So if you're someone who has been impacted by this decision and have been reported a denial of coverage, you can text Planned Parenthood National with the words birth control, and the number is 69866, and you will receive a response to your text and a follow-up email or phone call for more details. That's one of the first things that has come up in terms of access or increasing access. Of course, we know that in state by state, funding for Planned Parenthood has also been under attack in the last couple of years.
I have a question, which is promptly after this decision, there was, kind of a furor everywhere about it, in the media, of course, naturally as well. And Lawrence O'Donnell had reported that very few people would actually be impacted in terms of denial of coverage for their, for particular forms of contraception due to this ruling. But that doesn't seem to be the case. What is, what is your understanding of that and why he interpreted it that way? How many people, and perhaps this texting will help people get a better sense of how many people would really be affected?
Let's look at just even the numbers of Hobby Lobby. They own almost 600 stores across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So it's insurance coverage for those who have it through their employer includes not only them, but those who they cover in their family. So each person who's employed, this restriction applies to that, to their spouses, if they're female, to their daughters. I currently insure my family, and that includes two young adults, a female who has access to birth control if she chooses to use that access. So in terms of numbers and its impact, if we're talking about a national response and the numbers of companies, what we have to be concerned about is every person who's denied access to what is legal and appropriate preventative health care. So I think that to suggest that the number is small and this is something we shouldn't be concerned about is not a stance that I'm going to get behind, Allison. I think that we see across states where access to birth control and terminations of pregnancies have become, in some states, impossible. So when we talk about access, we talk about not only being able to get it through your insurance. So if you can't get it through your insurance, where are you going to go to get it? Can you afford that $1,000 that Supreme Court Justice Ginsburg, in her rebuttal to that decision, stated that we're talking about sort of above minimum wage, slightly employees who, as you and I know, many families in our country are currently, there are more than two people working more than two jobs, often children who are also working or college kids or helping to support the family. So we have families whose incomes are already quite limited, working more hours than needed in most situations prior to recovery from our recession, and still limited job options for many people across certain social and ethnic barriers, who are now going to be burdened with what could be a $50 or $60 a month birth control bill. That may mean I can't do it this month. That may mean stopping using a form of contraception. You know, those kinds of responses to this really don't take into account many people's home situations right now, and I think that's that strikes me as being very small framed and small thinking. I think that when we have a provision that says that birth control, just like terminations of pregnancy, are legal in this country, that access to them for women and for their partners to have birth control accessible in a heterosexual relationship is not something that we should see as being just okay that it's been denied now by a Supreme Court justice decision.
Why, as you pointed out in your opening comments on the program, there was a long drive by many health groups, medical groups, by many citizens to assure that this was part of the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
And in it, as you pointed out, it's defined as preventative care. Why is this considered preventative health care?
Well, I think we can all agree that, sexuality and sexual health is part of good health. Whether one chooses to live a certain way, and they, for example, we have some faith groups in our country and some people who feel very strongly that sexual intercourse specifically is something that should be saved. I'm using the word saved because it's what's mostly used in reference to that birth control shouldn't be available to people unless they're married. Well, I have tremendous respect for people who choose a certain lifestyle, whatever that lifestyle is. I think there's room in this world for everyone to make choices. What I do find problematic is when those religious beliefs impact the decision of others. And so birth control is part of the Affordable Care Act, and mandated in the Affordable Care Act, recognizes that contraception is part of preventative women's health services. You know, we even this week had the head of the Right to Life movement in this country admit what we know scientifically, that pregnancy is in fact a much more dangerous potential outcome for women than first trimester termination. So the Affordable Care Act and health care insurance reform that was passed by Congress and signed into law back in 2010 included guidelines that was supported by the Health Resources and Services Administration that under this act there would be coverage of, in addition to mammograms, screenings for cervical cancer, prenatal care, and birth control would be part of what's seen now as preventative services. So the definition of birth control being part of that is part of well women care. And screening for other kinds of health concerns like sexually transmitted diseases, counseling for those, contraceptive methods would all be part of that. And this included not only providing that prescription or providing that method, if it was an insertion of an IUD or counseling around the use of and proper use of a birth control, that would all now be reimbursable. So the fight to get that part of the Affordable Care Act was long and successful. And again, I think what we're seeing here is our faith-based groups, who, again, I will state this very clearly as a woman of faith myself, that they have every right not to impose or use these methods. What's now happening is that in addition to what was decided, if we want to go back to the decision again for a moment, Allison, is that after the Affordable Care Act was passed, there were a number of religious groups, churches, universities that were of religious universities who said, we will not follow this provision. And that's where President Obama supported and a decision was made that they would be able to sign a form, a particular kind of form, to their insurance carrier, and that insurance carrier would then be responsible for providing the contraceptive care directly to the employed through that university or church or religious not-for-profit. What happened right before everyone went away for July 4th weekend was a second decision by the Supreme Court that actually is accommodating, and the plaintiff in that case was Wheaton College, and they requested an injunction from the birth control benefit, and they did not want to fill out the paperwork to allow the insurance carrier to provide the direct service and pay for, not Wheaton College, but it would be out of the insurance pool for these benefits. And Wheaton College argued that that is even too burdensome on their religious rights, and the Supreme Court actually came to their side on that decision. What's difficult and conflicting about this decision is that this is yet another burden on the person trying to gain access to the insurance, as well as now they are trying to have a direct form to the Health and Human Services government, so it would be creating a second form, which, if all of us know, anytime you fill out any kind of form and it's government-related, you feel like you're putting it into the big black hole of bureaucracy. So we hope that this, what we know is going to happen is that it's a second way for them to exempt themselves from providing this access. And this decision created a very strongly worded and very powerfully written dissent by all three female justices. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote, quote, those who are bound by our decisions usually believe they can take us at our word, end quote. Not so today. She continued to say, and I quote, after expressly relying on the availability of the religious nonprofit accommodation to hold that the contraceptive coverage requirement violates the Religious Freedom from Act has applied closely to the court's decision and dissent in the Hobby Lobby, fears it might, retreats from that position. This action evinces disregard for even the newest of this court's precedents and undermines the confidence of this institution. What she's saying is that by allowing Wheaton College to not have to fill out this form, it's creating another part of what we can refer to as an administrative architecture of the Affordable Care Act and allowing this religious objection. So we now have a third-party administrator who's going to have to step in and start taking over providing contraceptive coverage for those employees and students who want it, separate from what had already been created and now is being denied as an access and path to allow for continuity of care of access to birth control. So what I see all of this, and I think what your listeners probably also see, is that it's a chipping away of birth control access. This is separate from, and what we can probably spend another few hours on, is the chipping away in access to what is legal in this country, and that's access to terminating a pregnancy. So it's an all-out war, as far as I see it, on reproductive rights. And I think that this places some very serious question on how is the Supreme Court justice and conservatives on the Roberts Court holding up to making decisions. We had the Hobby Lobby, as how government is now balancing religious objections and health insurance coverage for contraception. It's a pretty restrictive path. We have now objectors saying they don't want to fill out a form identifying their objection. They want the government, in this, and now with this most recent Wheaton College dissent, to create another pathway. And what we see is the objectors are just creating more and more dissent on how, in fact, they don't want to have any opportunity to provide access to birth control. I haven't seen a lot of written comments or interviews of people working at Hobby Lobby. I don't know if you have, Allison. I don't know whether or not there's any kind of gag order or protection of people certainly who work and need to hold on to their job, but it's been curious to me not seeing a lot of coverage, and we're all waiting to see what will happen or what can possibly happen in response to this.
Well, you know, one of the things that I see a lot of, and, you know, I'll raise that question with you, and we just have a couple of minutes here, so we may have to talk about it more after the break, but we can kind of raise the question now, is I see a lot of confusion about the question of religious freedom. It's unclear to me how an organization that is not specifically a church group, or, you know, a faith group of some kind, can be defined as having their religious freedom violated by following laws that have been agreed to in a consensus process in this country, and especially exempting an organization from that, especially at a time when it becomes more and more difficult, as you've pointed out, to pass any laws. Is really, really troubling. Does it have to be that every member of the board and the management shares a religious conviction? How can an organization, as I said, apart from a faith-based group of some kind that's so defined and has that tax status, how could they be construed as having religious convictions or religious freedoms as an organization? I just don't even understand where that fits. And one of the things that I see a lot of confusion about in the blogosphere is that a lot of people are confused and think, you know, they want to stand up for religious belief or religious freedom because they themselves have a faith practice or a spiritual practice, and so they want to extend that generosity to others, and they don't kind of understand very well the implications of this in terms of legal precedent for organizations to be, you know, self-defining in that kind of way. Your comments on this, and then we'll keep them short if you won't mind, and then we'll take a little break and come back to it. I think it's really
Of course. Well, I just want to point out that the Supreme Court, this Roberts Court, has already made it known that corporations are like private citizens when they allow them to make substantial political contributions for campaigns. So first of all, we already have a precedent that corporations are people. Secondly, I think what, although the First Amendment was not, and I am not a lawyer, but how I understand this is that, you know, the Constitution recognizes free exercise of religion, and this Religious Freedom Act that now is under question and making tightening, and we can talk more after the break, is that if a claim or a defense to persons that their religious exercise is substantially burdened by government is what they were responding to, and I can talk a little bit more about that when we come back.
Okay, great. That sounds fascinating. Stay tuned, listeners. We'll be back talking more with Barbara Glickstein about this recent Supreme Court decision, its effect on reproductive rights, and all that ensues. Stay with us for the second half of the show as we go into station identification. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Leaving. We're talking today about the recent Supreme Court decision and other decisions related to them and how that's affecting reproductive health, reproductive rights. My guest today is Barbara Glickstein. She also is a radio host of the award-winning program Health Styles on public radio in New York City. And she is the co-director of the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College, part of the City University of New York. She also blogs on the center website, which can be found at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. And she has a lot of interesting blogs and information on all matters related to public health policy at that website, and strongly suggest you go. You can also find the radio program Health Styles through those links. So welcome back to the second half of the show, everyone. Any people who are tuning in right now, this has been a super program. You may want, if you missed the first half, to catch up with it in the show Connect the Dots archives. It'll be available later today. And if you're enjoying this program, please don't forget to like us on iTunes, as well as pass the links and information along to friends who might be interested in listening and learning more from Barbara Glickstein. At the end of the first half of the show, we were talking about how companies like Hobby Lobby in this recent Supreme Court decision, you know, have come to be construed as holding religious convictions and having their religious freedoms violated. And Barbara, at the end of the last half hour, was pointing out that this is due to the Citizens United decision, which conferred, you know, kind of redefined corporations to be people as the basis for they're being able to make unlimited private campaign contributions. We thought that was bad enough, but here's a new wrinkle. You know, my question is, you know, how far does this interpretation of a corporation as a person go? I mean, can corporations get welfare? Are they entitled to health care, food stamps? You know, it seems like they're defined as people highly selectively. And it feels as though, in a sense, the American people are on the defensive because we don't know how that's going to be construed next, or how selectively, I should say, it's going to be construed for political or various end goals. You know, what's the problem here? And I find that as we began the conversation in the first half of the show, I find many people have, you know, whom I know and who are my followers in Facebook and elsewhere, you know, who really oppose Citizens United for the role it's played in creating the kind of stalemates in government which affect health issues and a whole range of issues across the board. Many people oppose that, but when they hear the religious freedom argument, then suddenly they're sort of like, well, everyone deserves religious freedom, and that's part of this country. Is this a religious freedom promoting decision?
That's the claim. I want to just go back to the decision because there is something I probably, I certainly have to admit, I had never heard the term or knew about, quote, the closely held end quote corporation, because that was the that has to do with why this corporation, Hobby Lobby, was the decision was based on this Justice Alito about the closely held corporation, which we all read about after the decision. And I had to look it up, like, well, what does that mean? So a closely held corporation, as I understand it, is one with a limited number of shareholders. So by definition, they're private companies, meaning that they don't share trade publicly. Mm-hmm. It's not clear to me how many shareholders a company would have to have in order to assert their the Religious Freedom Restoration Act or RFRA. But Hobby Lobby and other companies in the case are owned and controlled by members of a single family. Mm-hmm. So because of that, and because they have claimed that providing birth control is, as I mentioned before the break, an undue burden to their religiously held beliefs, they have used this closely held corporate model and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to justify the court, for the five justices to justify their decision. And now, how many of these corporations are here in the United States? It's maybe to go back to your quote by that person who said this wouldn't impact a lot of people. Now, I'm not suggesting, nor have I read, that all of these companies are going to claim the same decision or back, you know, follow in the steps of what Hobby Lobby has just gained. But the Census Bureau in 2012 said there are about 2.9 million corporations employed. There are more than 29 million people employed in these types of corporations. Hmm. So it isn't a small number. Of course, some of the response to all the heightened concerns following this decision, we heard from those who supported the Supreme Court decision that, in fact, it doesn't mean that all of those closely held corporations who have never publicly stated their strongly held religious beliefs can now all of a sudden become one. I'm not sure who will make those decisions and who will be deciding whether they in fact can use the Hobby Lobby decision for the same purposes of denying access to birth control to women in their companies. So it's not a small number. And again, you probably also have seen, Allison, that now there's been some rumblings of, can I now deny employment to someone who identifies as transgender or to someone who is out about being whatever their gender identity and sexual orientation is, because it really is in opposition to my strongly held religious beliefs. So we have some slippery slope things happening here. It hasn't been announced yet, although today the Senate Democrats will be unveiling a bill to override the Hobby Lobby decision. I mentioned that in the earlier part of the show. Senator Patty Murray, Democrat from Washington, and two other Democratic leaders are actually crafting a bill. I should mention who they are. Mark Udell, Democrat from Colorado, and Richard Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, have crafted a bill that proposes to come up in the vote in the Senate as early as next week. It would override the Supreme Court decision by requiring for-profit corporations like Hobby Lobby to provide and pay for contraception and other health coverage mandated by the Affordable Care Act, because we are concerned that this is the beginning of chipping away of some other provisions. And the bill would basically be very tough, as I mentioned. It's a Democratic-controlled Senate, but there are some Democrats from more conservative states who are facing very tough re-election fights in November, and they're going to be weighing the potential for political backlash if they support this bill. There are some efforts in the House to also craft a similar companion bill on the contraceptive issue, but again, I'm not very optimistic. There must absolutely be a response, and it will be to tighten the language of the Religious Freedom Act and make it harder to have it interpreted in the way that the Supreme Court did. The other thing that I understand, and again, I'm not a lawyer, a scholar in law, but the other thing the Supreme Court decision did is that It stated a federal interpretation of the law, where in fact when it was passed and signed into law by Senator Clinton, that decision actually allowed still states to have the liberty to create their own laws. So I don't know whether that's a loophole or another opportunity for each state now to introduce a law to exercise that they're stating that this law was not intended to extend the same protection to for-profit corporations, and so this is opening up a whole other opportunity for them to start whittling away on other rights or human rights, in this instance in terms of if it's used against the LGBTQ community, but certainly in terms of contraceptive coverage, whether or not each state now would have an opportunity to develop stronger language. So there's probably a lot more for us to keep our eyes and ears open to. I certainly am concerned, as are others in the community of activists for rights of people to both have access to birth control, but also there are concerns in the community of human rights whether or not this will now be used to be discriminatory towards people of the LGBT community. I also want to point out some very important writings that I've been following, and Allison, if I can mention rhrealitycheck.org, which is a source that I go to regularly. It's a news analysis and commentary on reproductive and sexual health and justice. And an article written on July 1st by one of their reporters, Renee Bracey Sherman, and the title of that article is "A Right to Contraception Without Access is a Disaster for the Black Community." And she writes about how this decision for black women and really creates a denial of access in communities that we know, because of health disparities and issues of racial discrimination historically around access to birth control and access in terms of equity of and resources and money, that this is seriously going to impact that population of women. So I mentioned earlier that an IUD, which is a very effective form of contraception, is expensive. It can really cost anywhere from $500 to $1,000 without insurance. This is a desirable form of birth control in that community, and it was a big opportunity that was afforded to all women, and particularly women of color, with this provision of the Affordable Care Act. And now, in this dissenting, Justice Beto Ginsburg, as I mentioned, noted that for minimum wage employees in some of these private, these corporations that will be enforcing this, they're making $7.25 an hour. Black women make up almost 16% of the female minimum wage workers, and so policies like this will disproportionately affect them and their families.
One of the things that strikes me about this is, let's talk a little bit about the selectivity of the issue, because the range of issues that you're discussing are targeted at specific segments of the population according to religious beliefs. Some might call them prejudices. There's a lot going on in terms of how the call to religious freedom is being asked for and applied. And so, speaking to the fact that the court basically said, well, this is only just for this and it's not for anything else, how can a precedent set at the highest level just be for the preference of, that particular case as per the preference of the justices? Why wouldn't this apply to, for example, people with religious objections to vaccinations?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think it was stated in the opinion that this would not be used against vaccinations and blood transfusions. That was stated in the Supreme Court decision. Allison, I saw a wonderful graphic, very powerful graphic, at a conference 2 years ago that showed the something that I think we all know. So, you know, I'm a big believer in democracy. I'm a big believer in the role of every citizen's action to be an active citizen of the United States and to participate in government. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it is, we have this layer, right? We have these, you know, we have the Supreme Court, we have the presidency, and we have the Senate and the House. And they, the reason it was designed this way was for checks and balances, if we all remember our early grade school civic.
That's right.
You know, so here we have the Supreme Court making a decision. You know, the question is, how politicized has the Supreme Court become? And I think for those who, whatever side of the coin on a decision you are, you can find analyses that would say this is a very, these are very political decisions. I mentioned earlier, and I'm pointing out a fact, it was all five white men of Roman Catholic faith who sided on this decision. And I think probably some of your listeners or those who aren't listening, but we know that they would point out other decisions that have been made that perhaps for me politically I've been aligned with, and their feelings would be that this was politically a leftist decision on the Supreme Court. I think what we have to acknowledge is that from there's this huge layer now from the people of the United States to the government of the United States called the corporations. And I think that the role of corporations in ruling and making decisions that impact each and every one of us in the United States has gotten out of control. And so the power of corporate cap power, corporate lobbying power, politicians being afraid to really vote on decisions that the majority of perhaps the people in their community support because of the power of the corporation in their town that's funding them tremendously for their reelection campaigns, which seems to be the first thing people think about after they've been elected is how am I going to be reelected? That we have an environment currently in our country where corporate power and corporate influence has taken a tremendous, tremendous role in decision making in our country.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that.
And I know from all of the issues that you follow that this is not just here we're seeing it. You know, I know I learn all about fracking from following you, Allison, and
right.
you have been very, very closely, very diligently reporting on that issue. And I raise it because in that instance as well,
yes,
the science, both from the scientific community, the environmental science community, the public health community, the legal community, the evidence is being trumped by politics and corporate influence.
Yes,
and, you know, this is really a wake-up call. We have lots of wake-up calls. I use that term, and I'm finding myself using it way more than I thought I would need to in 2014 in our 21st century. But, you know, we all know that many decisions are not being made based on what is good science, good public health science, good environmental science, good straight science, whatever field it is. And we know that that's the influence of politics, and we know that's the influence of political power, influence of money, and it makes it really hard to stay on course in reporting. I know that you are very diligent about the sources that you use, as I hope I am, and respectfully believe that, you know, sometimes people say, well, you're not giving the other side. And I will say, well, the other side's got all of traditional media and, you know, legacy media reporting on it. And I'm going to try and give a little bit of window of opportunity to people who are also doing good science who don't seem to get called on by a lot of reporters. And I commend
true.
You because I know, I thank you for bringing me on today, but in addition to that opportunity, I know that you are bringing the voices to your platforms and digital media and radio platform of people who are also, you know, doing good science, doing good reporting, who often are not able to push past a bigger wall of prevention of getting word out there about what in fact is our facts as well. So we have we're activists, we're advocates, and we're not going away, are we, Allison?
No, I hope not.
No, we're not going away.
I hope not. But, you know, one of the things, too, is that there are many, many voices out there, and as there are more, what you describe, I mean, here we can just talk about the media a little bit, since you kind of have created an opening for that. You know, in the media, there are many voices, and there are many, many wake-up calls, as you point out, more than we ever hope to see. I certainly share that response. As a result, also, I think that there is both, that also creates both a kind of fever pitch to the news headlines, how things are reported. There's almost like a, you know, there's a, because of the fact that the media is in a transition in terms of what its economic basis is from the old media to, you know, we're kind of in the Wild West where people are seeking eyeballs in order to get ads on websites, and there's, you know, a transition in the model. There's almost like a panic in the media, and some, you know, through that comes some coverage, and through that as well, people kind of get overwhelmed and turned off, and don't follow the issues or see the interconnection between the different issues. So, you know, since your organization is about media and policy and the interplay between them, I'd love your thoughts or comments about that.
Well, the reason why Diana Mason, my colleague, and I started the Center for Health, Media, and Policy is that we believe the public is very educatable. We believe that when the job of journalists is to report on issues in a way that help them make decisions, not make decisions for them. And I think that in order for a public to be informed around a policy and its impact on them as an individual, as a member of a family, a member of a community, and a member of this country or globally, that our reporting on things cannot just be a political reporting, but an opportunity to help them understand what the issue is. And so how to unpack that and do it in a way that allows people to make that decision, and it will be based on their own understanding of the issue, their own personal political values, their own moral judgment. You know, this is not to remove those processes of how one makes a decision. But when you only choose to report certain politicians' response to global warming, certain scientists who don't believe global warming exists, and provide that as the headline, and not report the evidence that's available to support global warming, or choose your issue, then in fact you're not doing a good job. And by not reporting on the issue, you're also making an editorial decision to not report and educate the community on what fracking is, or what does this decision mean to a person whose only access to birth control may be through her insurance, who works for Hobby Lobby, then what? So I think that, you know, I truly believe, I grew up in a home where it was in the days where there were 5 daily newspapers and we got them all. I really attribute my parents being civic-minded, activists, community organizers, and Democrats, in the true sense of the word, that we had friends who didn't have the same political opinion, and I remember sitting around watching my parents be engaged in very, very good conversations about political positions, and then everyone left and shook hands and had dinner again the following week, or a picnic, or whatever it was. And I suggest that we start talking to each other to help better understand our positions, but to allow room for there to be decisions that are based on good science, not politics or corporate power.
And also, you know, there's also complexity to science. I mean, I think in this case, there's probably, you know, this is something that's misunderstood, that's clearly agreed to, but there are also different ranges of science, as we find out when we go toward the integrative medical side, you know, in terms of what is valued and not. So there's also a place for debate about science, and I don't like to see a kind of monolithic science painted in a monolithic way.
Absolutely.
But where there
not.
Is universal agreement, I think, as in this case, and it's being ignored, and it's also true with climate science. This really demands a lot of citizens. There's a lot of you know, kind of a range of places where we're seeing common problems. There's a range of complexity, and I really salute you and your work in really tackling those in a very credible way so that people can be better informed. I mean, I think it's really invaluable.
Well, thank you. I do believe, and I agree with you, you know, science, I think the definition of the word science is to know. And in this case that we spent the last hour talking about, there's a very strong difference of opinion, one based on current scientific standards, that IUDs are not abortifacients, they are in fact birth control, that the time of conception is when it is implanted into the uterus, and as opposed to what the stance was or is based on their religious beliefs that was brought to the Supreme Court and this decision was made. So I think what we have here is what might be decided from the scientific and medical community as being fact has now been put aside, and a decision based on what's considered burden or extensive burden to Hobby Lobby and closely held corporations like them has taken what we know to be scientific fact, and the Supreme Court decision has really upended that.
So I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you for being with me today on Connect the Dots, Barbara Glickstein. Listeners, please go to her website, www.centerforhealthmediapolicy. From that, you can also access her radio program, Health Styles. Thank you so much for being with us today, Barbara. It's just been fantastic having you on and in dialogue. I hope we have more opportunities.
Thank you. Look forward to that.
Thank you, listeners, and next week we'll be back with the next edition of Connect the Dots. We're here every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm Allison Rose Levy.